In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 299. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the show today, David Stockman. David Stockman is former director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan, and his most recent book, which is indispensable and which I urge upon you, is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Not only are you going to get an absolutely airtight and devastating case against the bailouts of 08 and the policies that were pursued in the wake of the financial crisis, you're not going to see anything better than the case that David Stockman makes against all that, but it's a sweeping revisionist account of 20th century American economic history. Absolutely great. And for those of you who enjoy listening to audiobooks so that you can get stuff done while you're driving, you can get The Great Deformation as part of my free audiobook offer at tomwoodsaudio.com. Everything we talk about here, links, articles mentioned, websites, all of this can be found on the show notes page for this episode, which is tomwoods.com/299. David Stockman, welcome back to the show.
Very happy to be with you, Tom.
I was just looking over davidstockmanscontracorner.com, and I decided, as much as I'd like to talk about Japan and China, and we'll get to those, I really want to do a potpourri discussion with you because there's so many interesting topics you've got here. You've got, first of all, an attack on Krugman and a guy named Ken Rogoff of Harvard for basically incredibly boneheaded suggestions, but not just boneheaded, but really almost evil. In the case of Rogoff, almost evil. He's recommending, as a way of helping central banks carry out their policies more effectively, the abolition of cash altogether. Now, what is the obstacle that cash presents to the monetary authorities? Why do they hate cash so much?
Well, it is really amazing. It's almost hard to believe that a Harvard professor of some renown would be traveling around the world, not simply writing a blog or a short article, but traveling the policy circuits of the world, advocating the abolition of cash in order to facilitate a further expansion of monetary policy in the misguided drive underway now against deflation. In other words, they want the nominal interest rate to go in negative territory. It's already there at the ECB for the short-term deposit facility, but they would like to drive nominal interest rates negative. The problem with that is very quickly people would realize that they're better off in cash than they are in a depository institution where the central bank has forced the yield into negative territory. So how do they solve that problem? They solve that problem, really unbelievable, by taking all the greenbacks out of your wallet and all the coins out of your pocket, forcing you to park your liquid funds in a regulated money market or bank, and then pay for the privilege of keeping your liquid funds there at some negative interest rate that might be 1 or 2 or 3, all of this part of some harebrained, nonsensical scheme to restart the world economy, or the economy at least of Europe, Japan, and elsewhere, by reviving inflation. There's so many moving pieces to that that are just nonsensical that you don't know where to start, except I think it's pretty well proven over the last 50 years or not longer that more inflation has nothing to do with real prosperity, real growth, real jobs, real wealth generation. And yet we're now in the thrall, I would say, of a fraternity of central bankers and their hirelings in academia, like both Krugman and Rogoff, who are advocating policies and actions by the central banks that are positively ridiculous and dangerous and amount, as I've said before, to an economic coup d'etat. You know, if you were going to say we're going to punish all the savers of America, which there are tens of millions, by forcing them to pay money to keep their deposits, and you put that to a vote in Congress because it's really a fiscal action, a regulatory action, it wouldn't see the light of day. It couldn't find a sponsor. You know, even Bernie Sanders, the socialist from Vermont, wouldn't stand up for that one. And yet, we have central banks all over the world ready to do this, effectively doing it by driving interest rates in the short term into negative territory after inflation. And now we have academics like Professor Rogoff running around suggesting that we actually drive interest rates negative, even in nominal terms, which after inflation and taxes would mean what? People are losing 5% of their money every year because the government, policies have decided that's the thing to do. It's really crazy.
You know, David, you were mentioning just now that there's no connection between money growth and genuine economic progress. And I note that you have a piece at davidstockmanscontracorner.com in which you express your frustration at the kind of offhand comments. And this drives me crazy, too, that we'll read in Bloomberg and these financial outlets where they just take for granted the entire interventionist or Keynesian apparatus. They take it for granted as if it's simply obvious. So you single out this sentence from a Bloomberg article. Industrial profits in China fell the most in 2 years, underscoring the need for looser monetary conditions as the world's second largest economy slows. So that's just stated as if it's an obvious fact rather than a clear, at the very least, a highly debatable proposition.
Exactly right. In other words, my point in that post was to say that this Keynesian narrative has gotten so embedded in the mainstream discussion that reporters for the so-called financial press, who basically are echo chambers or Xerox machines that repost the press releases they get from official institutions or from their sources at the Fed or the Treasury or whatever, but it's gotten so embedded in the narrative that this particular writer thinks nothing of making a declarative sentence that a tiny change in China, and after all, I don't think China is some remarkable, outbreak of free market capitalism by any means. Everyone knows it's red capitalism. It's driven from the center. It's powered by, the greatest credit bubble in history. But even if you couldn't see that, and even if you're based in Hong Kong and have been watching it for quite a while, as this reporter was, the fact that industrial profits have dropped 2% year over year from October this year to October last year would prompt the clause in that opening sentence that said, oh, we must need more money printing, is just, I think, a powerful case in point. Now, it might be, it should have been reminded or known to this particular Bloomberg reporter, and frankly, the Reuters reporters and the Wall Street Journal reporters are just bad, that China's credit has grown from outstanding public and private from $1 trillion in the year 2000 to $25 trillion today. Never in history has there been a 25x increase in the amount of debt outstanding in such a short period of time. And so, therefore, it's obvious that this is a massive monetary credit speculative bubble that has huge problems. And certainly, those problems aren't going to be ameliorated or cured by even more monetary ease, which, you know, was the first thing that came off his word processor in the first sentence of that article.
David, how, though, do we disentangle what is money-driven in China and what really may be the result of, well, maybe somewhat looser controls over the economy. Because certainly, in the cities anyway, it does seem like people's living standards are rising. So there is some phenomenon taking place.
Oh, yeah. The problem in China is that they developed too rapidly the easy way with massive doses of credit and without the disciplines of real markets and, a legal framework, including bankruptcy, that would allow for the normal mechanisms of free market or capitalist growth to set in and create a solid foundation of, rising living standards and a growing, expanding economy. I don't think you have the prosperity, but it was achieved through the printing press, in part, compelled by policies in the West. The Fed was running the printing press like no tomorrow over the last 14 years, during the same period that I cited about Japan. The balance sheet of the Fed went from $500 billion in the year 2000 to $4.5 trillion today, 9x, just crazy, nothing like this in history. That would have, if left unaddressed by the People's Bank of China, would have caused their exchange rate to soar. That would have fundamentally undermined their export-driven mercantilist model. They couldn't abide by that because it would have caused unrest in the hinterlands and, the comrades and commissars running the system from Beijing weren't about to tolerate that. So they discovered the printing press, and they basically bought dollars in order to peg the RMB at a level consistent with their massive export expansion, and not allow it to appreciate against the dollar, which was being trashed by the Federal Reserve. So in the process, then, of defending or pegging their currency, and I don't justify it, I'm only saying this is what all the East Asian export mercantilist model policies did in Korea, Japan, but especially in China. What they did was they bought massive amounts of dollars, sold the RMB in financial transactions. That did two things. One, it massively expanded the money supply of RMB internally in China and fueled this crazy borrowing and building speculative boom they had. But it also then resulted in the accumulation of something like $4 trillion worth of reserves, which aren't really reserves. That's just the accumulation of dollar claims that resulted from their whole policy of defending against the waves of dollars coming from the Fed and trying to build overnight a modern economy through a massive credit expansion and monetary stimulation. I think it's a house of cards. I think they've got, as we all well know, there's empty cities everywhere, empty malls, airports that aren't used, fast rail built around the country, much of it which is too dangerous to use at high speed, highways to nowhere, bridges that aren't used. There's a story just out 2 days ago where the Monetary Reform Commission in Beijing itself, the official government institution, said we believe that more than $7 trillion of investment has been wasted over the last 5 or 10 years as a result of this massive building and borrowing and credit spree that they've had. So there's a lot to sort out in China, but I think it's part of the global bubble that has been created by all the central banks doing the same thing, expanding their balance sheets, repressing, suppressing interest rates, monetizing sovereign debt. The whole menu has been done worldwide, Bank of Japan, ECB, United States, Bank of England, People's Bank of China, and it has created a massive, unstable, unsustainable global boom and financial bubble that I believe is going to come unwound any time now, and China is going to be part of the hard landing. The idea that they're going to be able to have a soft landing, and that you have deaf Keynesians who used to be communists running the levers of economic control out of Beijing is just one of the wildest fairy tales and illusory, dreams that you can imagine, and yet it's one that's peddled by Wall Street every day, because the only thing that Wall Street cares about now is keeping the game going hour by hour, day by day, and that's based on one or another central bank continuing to put juice into the system. It's really pretty pathetic. I think the capital markets have been destroyed by the central banks. There is no honest price discovery. Nothing out in those markets, the S&P 500 or the yield on the 10-year bond in the United States or Italy or Germany, is an honest price. How in the world could someone want to own an Italian 10-year bond at 1.99% when Italy is bankrupt and is likely to break up either politically or be driven out of the euro sometime over the next few years? Nothing is remotely being priced based on real risk, real economics, and a sober view of the future. It's all being priced on, is the ECB, for example, going to go into QE? If it does, let's buy all these sovereign bonds, because once the central bank starts buying them, the price will go up. We can pocket the yield, fund it on repo, which is, you know, zero cost overnight money, and laugh all the way to the bank. This is what's going on all over the world. It's worse in Japan even than in Europe. It's crazy what's happening in Japan. China is just as bad.
Well, David, assuming this happens in China, that there is a reversal because of all the artificial credit creation, what do you think the effects, the ripple effects, would be on the United States economy and on the U.S. consumer?
I think the ripple effects is there is a horrendous industrial deflation coming down the pike on a global basis. The result of the China boom was to create immense excess demand for oil, for copper, for iron ore, for nickel, for aluminum, and you can go on down the line. Secondly, as we know from good Austrian economics, when you have artificially low interest rates, that causes malinvestment. So downstream of the mining sector that got way overbuilt because prices were bid to extreme highs, oil over $100, $150 at the last peak, iron ore $200 a ton, sitting under 70 or around 70 today. You had massive overbuilding of the mining and raw material sector. That then fueled the expansion of the manufacturing, material conversion, and fabrication sectors. So there's massive excess capacity in China and throughout the so-called emerging markets, Brazil, Indonesia, Korea, and elsewhere. And so, therefore, we have vastly overbuilt our fixed capital structure, from iron ore mines to bulk carriers to port facilities to steel works in China, aluminum smelters, and so forth. So what does this mean? It means that as the system, the bubble bursts and unwinds, there's going to be a huge scramble for market share. This is what you can see right now in oil. Saudi Arabia has announced again this morning or yesterday they're cutting prices for December yet another time. The same thing's happening in most other industrial commodities. Certainly iron ore is a leading case. And so it's going to cause an enormous amount of downward price spiral and dumping of excess commodities and excess industrial goods on the world market. And, in some ways, that's going to be helpful to consumers because it'll mean prices are lower. But on the other hand, all of that capacity has been funded with debt of one type or another, emerging market bonds, high yield energy patch, junk bonds here, bank loans in Europe, which are huge, that have gone out to the transportation and shipping sector of the world and so forth. There's going to be huge carnage in the financial infrastructure that was, you know, that rose up to fund this massive spree of investment and malinvestment that occurred over the last 10 or 15 years.
David, on Japan, comment on this observation. It seems to me that when we were arguing about austerity, so-called, Paul Krugman was very quick to announce the failure of austerity, even though the so-called austerity, you needed a magnifying glass to see it in most cases. There was almost this very, very little retrenchment in the size of government and in government spending. But we know that austerity has failed. Whereas on the other hand, in Japan, the effect has not been minuscule, by contrast, where in austerity, if you had any at all, there was very little. Whereas in Japan, they've had dose after dose after dose of Keynesian so-called medicine over more than two decades. And as you showed in an article that I read on your site a couple weeks ago, their index of total industrial production is unchanged after all these doses of Keynesianism, and they won't admit defeat there. Austerity has failed, they know, but they'll never say Keynesianism failed.
Yeah, it's one of these propositions that academics love, and that is they argue the contrafactual. In other words, it hasn't failed. You didn't do enough. Now, I say, wait a minute. I can remember well 1981 when I first went into the White House in the Reagan administration. We were visited by a group of senior financial officials, Ministry of Finance officials from Japan, worried that maybe the Reagan plan would lead to too big a deficit. And they were deficit hawks back then, 1980, official Japan. Their debt to GDP was 30%.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. Okay. And then they had their bubble, which was really induced in the mid-80s when Jim Baker and the rest of them forced them to, revalue the yen sharply. They countered that by a massive expansion of lending internally. They got their huge real estate boom. The economy collapsed. And very shortly after that happened in 1990, they went all out Keynesian monetary and fiscal stimulus. And here we are today, and their debt to GDP is off the charts. It's 240% instead of being the best in the world in terms of fiscal discipline where they are today, where they were in 1980 as a young, productive, miracle economy. They're today, 35 years later, a old age colony, effectively, that has buried itself in the most monumental, accretion of public debt ever imagined, 240% of GDP. And they now have a government that is unwilling to do anything about it. But that's what this whole snap election is about. They're going to postpone the scheduled consumption tax increase that was to happen next year for another two or three years. Now, I'm not arguing for big taxes or as opposed to spending, but the point is they have been doing this so long. I had a chart in the blog that you referred to that showed that since 1992, their revenue has not gone anywhere. About 400, it's been about roughly 45 trillion yen a year. They're spending, because they're getting older and older, and because they were doing all this Keynesian, road building in places where nobody lived and so forth, has risen to 100 billion. You look at that chart, and essentially they've become locked into a permanent fiscal condition where they're raising less than 50 cents on every dollar they're spending. And the difference is being added to the national debt, and all of the incremental debt is being bought by the bank, BOJ, the Bank of Japan. In other words, it's being 100% monetized, because no one in their right mind today wants to buy a 10-year Japanese government bond at a yield of 0.4 or 0.4%, which is what the alleged market price is. So if you can imagine the way that they have contorted and twisted and backed themselves in to this, you know, this disaster of money printing and borrowing, it's pretty remarkable. I don't think even in the year 2000 anybody could have imagined a nation that's about ready to reinforce in a big way this Abenomics, which is, you know, absolute Keynesian snake oil like has never been practiced before. And yet somehow the media and the government has convinced the population of Japan that we're going to destroy the purchasing power of the yen. We're going to bury you if you're still working in debt. Somehow they've convinced the population that this is this is going to work in the long run. There will be a day of reckoning. I think there is going to be a major financial and fiscal and social crisis in Japan. And that may be where the fire starts this time. Not because Japan is a subprime nation, not just, you know, the subprime housing problem we had in 06 and 07 and 2008. Japan has maneuvered itself into, you know, the status of a subprime nation that is nearing the end of the rope in terms of financial viability.
Well, David, I want to tell the listeners that on the I have a newly redesigned website at tomwoods.com, and on the resources page, tomwoods.com/resources, I list only a handful of really indispensable websites, and yours is one of them. And more than that, I want to tell people, even if you think I'm sick of getting newsletters in my email box is full, okay, we'll cancel a few of those so that you can get David Stockman's newsletter, because it I don't know how you find all these great stories, and I don't know how you write all these great stories, but it helps keep me informed, and it'll help keep you guys informed as well. David Stockman, thanks for your time today. Best to you in the new year, and I hope our fortunes should change in the new year.
Hopefully, and very good to talk to you and sort of lay out some of these issues, because as I said before, we are in a very dangerous time, and people need to understand how deep these difficulties are, and how you know much at variance the truth is from what you hear in the daily mainstream media, bubble vision, and talking heads who tell you to keep buying stock. I mean, these markets are dangerous. What people really need to do is get out of harm's way and wait for the storm to pass.
Well, David, thanks again. Important advice. We'll talk to you again in 2015, I hope.
Okay, very good.
All right. Now, remember, everybody, tomwoods.com/299. Now, even if you're not interested in any of the resources we talked about or the articles that I mentioned, all of those will be linked there. I've got a couple of related episodes there. I've got a breakdown of what was covered. I've got David's website. I've got his background. I've got all this stuff. I still would like you to look at it. tomwoods.com/299, because it's just a thing of beauty. I'm just so happy that we've got proper show notes pages now. I want you to look at it, because every show is going to look like that. Every page for every show is going to look like tomwoods.com/299, where you can just go and be assured that everything interesting in that episode that you might want to read or follow up on, or web resources that you might want to take a look at, they'll all be conveniently collected there. Of course, make sure and subscribe to the show for your daily serving of liberty education over at tomwoods.com. You can subscribe via iTunes or Stitcher using the links over there. Because next week, we've got some great programs lined up for you. As always, we're talking to Kelly Vlahos about Hillary Clinton. Yeah, I know nobody wants to talk about Hillary Clinton, but what's relevant are Hillary's foreign policy views, which are basically neocon. And yet you have all these left liberals running around saying, I'm ready for Hillary. Hello? Do you have any principles whatsoever? So we're going to talk about that. Connor Boyack will join us once again to talk about his brand new book, Feardom, about how governments use fear to manipulate their populations. Then Jim Powell will join us to talk about his book, Greatest Emancipations, about how exactly the West went about abolishing slavery. It's a very interesting story. So that and more coming up next week. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. We'll see you next week.